Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every other week, two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm his very sexy, maybe vampire friend, Duncan Nichol.
Well, that doesn't narrow it down in even the slightest, but this week we are reviewing From Blood and Ash by Jennifer L. Armentrout. This is a book I read pretty shortly after it came out. I think I genuinely might have actually been caught up in the, like, excitement of its post-release when it was big news in the fantasy space. It was 2020, it was a pandemic year. I used to listen to this while I was walking around in my one time a day I was allowed outside, so maybe the reason I really liked this book the first time is that it was pandemic, and I, like Poppy, also felt quite restrained and yearning to break free.
Then you felt a bigger sense of connection to her than I did throughout this entire book, mate. Not to give too much away, Geordie, but this was a book that never quite hooked me. And I don't want to say that it was all awful, because I don't want to completely chuck this book to the flames. But this book didn't hook me to such an extent. Genuinely, there were so many times where I just kind of forgot that I needed to read this book. Like, it was leaving zero impression. To the point of which, and this is hands in the air here, I should have done better. It got to about 11:30 last night. I realised I had not finished the book. And then I realised I still had about a third to go, and I thought I was much closer to that ending. Ooh. So I read the last third of this book between like 11:30 and 2:30 in the morning. So be real here. The end of this book is blurry. I remember the major plot twists, and then there was way more content than I thought. And then I remember the end happened.
First of all, I'll bear in mind that the ending of the book may be hazy. I'll try and make sure that we're all on the same page about what happens. But I think that is really kind of reasonable. I mean, for one thing, staying up between 11:30 and 2:30 a.m. to read a book, the last time I did that, it was because I could not put the book down. So that sounds like you loved it, Duncan. However, that really does make sense to me. Because, as you rightly said, there's a big, exciting twist around about the last two-thirds of the book, maybe like 70% of the way through. And in my memory, that's like right before the end. Huge twist, then the emotional fallout of that twist, and then boom, big cliffhanger. Gotta wait for that next book. And I remember the reason that I read the second book at all, even though I had soured on the book quite a lot by the time we got to the end, especially because of the big twist. I had to read on because of how big the twist was and what a big cliffhanger it left me on. More fool me, let me tell you. Any complaints I have about this book, I have a substantially increased version of that complaint in the subsequent book.
By that logic, if someone absolutely loves the first book, would they love the second?
Well, let me tell you this, Duncan. You read this book on Kindle, right?
Yes, I did. Actually, I got it given to me by a good friend called Kelly, who lent me their whole Kindle so I could read this. So thank you, Kelly.
Thank you, Kelly. That is very generous of you. I hope Ben Duncan has rewarded you appropriately by removing your Kindle that contains this book and throwing it in the fire. You read this on Kindle, so you might not be aware. I've read this as audiobook, by the way. So I was also not aware that this book is about 610 pages long in paperback.
Whew.
Yeah, and that feels excessive considering the amount of stuff that actually happens in the book. Like, it does not need to be this long.
It genuinely gives Eye of the World a run for its money for how much of a wheel spinner the opening, like, 100 odd pages feel like. Not that there isn't good things, no, that's a lie. Not that there aren't things occurring on page, but it certainly takes its time. And some of that I appreciated it, some of it I didn't. The key thing is, though, is how
it's a very, very repetitious book.
Or things happen, Poppy thinks about them. Poppy reflects on them. Poppy thinks what she would rather have had happened. Poppy does something new.
Genuinely, scenes themselves are repetitious. There's this insane bit in the latter third where Poppy says to Hawk, "You're outrageous," and then he says something snippy and like, "Oh my god, you being snippy at me makes me so horny." And then she says, "Ugh, you're incorrigible." And then he says, "You think that I'm incorrigible makes me horny." I am barely changing the lines of dialogue there. It is astonishing. It's like she wrote two lines of dialogue and couldn't pick her favorite, so she just kept the same one directly next to one another. I had a point. I forgot what it was, though.
Now, like I said, this book was mostly kind of a flat line with a few little ups and quite a few downs. Something that I did kind of appreciate is that this book is very upfront for what it's about. Sure. The opening chapter of this book will let you know immediately, I feel, if it's for you or not. And for me, it was not. But I do appreciate that it's at least upfront with what it's going on about. So let's come back to it. Main character is called Poppy. She is the maiden. She has been chosen by the aristocracy to be the... what's the word? I suppose the virgin, that is the word actually. The pure-hearted maiden. She must keep herself pure and stay away from the commoners and their vices for the good of some ritual thingy. But Poppy's a young woman. She wants to explore the world. She wants to know people, Geordie, in all the ways. So in the opening scene, she has snuck away to the local brothel.
To be clear, she hasn't gone there for the purposes of completely forsaking her role as the maiden, capital T, capital M. But she's gone there because it is in order to experience vivacity. She's gone to drink, she's gone to play cards with rough men who go to the outside world to fight the craven there and of course watch other people get fondled and stuff. It's one of the interesting contradictions that the book has, which is that it places Poppy. Her story is about personal development, is about her developing a sense and yearning for freedom, and breaking free of the constraints that have been put on her by society. But she kind of starts there, right? The opening scene, the inciting incident, is her first kiss with Hawk Flynn, which, you know, completely blows aside what she is supposed to do as the maiden.
Okay, we're going to have to circle back to the name Hawk Flynn a second. That is another big red flag. You know if you're going to good for this book moment when that character walks in. But you're right, it's very clear from the off, you're like, all these kind of big moments on her journey, it's not a, will I forsake my position? It's more of a, right, I'm forsaking my mission. I am going down a different path, and we're with her for that journey.
It's for Sook. The horse has bolted. That's the tricky thing, and something that keeps being brought up, which is that the book doesn't actually have any stakes. Because the main conflict which Poppy is concerned about is, I have this role as the maiden. My maidenness is tied into this big ascension ritual which is coming up, where a bunch of the sons and daughters of the kingdom will go through a magical ritual, the details of which are deliberately secret both to the people and to the reader, to become the ascended, the quasi-immortal beings who run their society. Her being the maiden is somehow tied into this. We don't know as readers, even she doesn't know what her role she has to play. But it all depends on whether the gods will find her worthy, and her maidenness is what she will be judged by. And as is frequently pointed out between her and her friend Tawny, she's already impure by their definition. She doesn't follow the creed that's been set out for her. She goes along with it in public, but in private, she's already given most of this stuff up.
To be clear, we're using the language of the world. This is not obviously our own personal views.
Yeah. The point is that if the gods will find her unworthy, there aren't any choices which Poppy can make between now and then which are going to change that. because even before the book started, she was doing stuff the maiden wasn't supposed to do. She was learning to fight. She was sneaking out of the castle. She was letting people see her face. She was touching people. The only thing that really changes from the start of the book, up until she's having these conversations, is she has a first kiss, which is another toe across the line. So we as readers are never in a point of, oh, is Poppy going to be endangered by the stuff she's choosing to do? Well, as long as she doesn't tell people around her, then the answer is no.
What this scene also does, besides kind of setting that path, is it gives us our introduction to our romantic interest of the novel. The previous mentioned Hawk Flynn, the Mr. Darcy of the piece.
You're being a bit harsh to Mr. Darcy.
Oh, I'm being horrible to Mr. Darcy in that statement.
Now, right from the start, Duncan, you said, upon reading the first chapter, you're going to be able to decide whether this is the right book for you.
And that's because of fetishes. Basically, the fundamental sexy thing of this book is a continuous stream, and Bill Shakespeare would be proud, of mistaken identity and somewhat pushy men.
It's about secret identities pushing. Is dubious the right word?
Yeah, dubious.
Yeah, dubious consent. Right from the start, she has to hide in a room. She's directed by someone who works at a brothel to hide in a room upstairs to escape one of her bodyguards who's come to the brothel. She doesn't want to be recognized. Already in that room is her love interest. Because she stole a cloak from someone else, he thinks he's the owner of that cloak, who he has a prior romantic relationship with. So he turns her about, says, oh, I didn't expect to see you here tonight, and he lays a big kiss on her. And of course, this is preceded by lots of descriptions about how sexy Hawk Flynn is, and his big, large male body. His chest is constantly hard, which I find very funny, because that's not how muscles work. That means he is constantly... flexing his pecs. But,
Do you know what I was wondering? And this is a crazy point, Jordy. How hairy is Hawk Flynn's chest?
You know, I'm going to say he doesn't have a hairy chest, because the hair in his chest is not mentioned. The only hair that's mentioned that is not on his head, I think, is the sort of snail trail leading down towards his belt. That is definitely commented on during the sex scene towards the end of the book.
Disappointed. But, you know, it doesn't always have to be for my interest. So we get this scene.
Well, I think that is actually a very deliberate choice. And I'm pleased that you brought it up, because there are lots of things about Hawk's appearance which are made explicit for the reader. But there are other things which are left vague, and I think his level of hairiness is when it is deliberately left out, because you are supposed to paint onto Hawk the stuff you think is sexy. I, right before this episode, was doing some research to make sure that I made that I had a character's names correct, which I tried to do a lot before episodes recently, and I ran into some fan art of what Hawk Flynn looks like, and I went, oh, that is not even remotely what I thought he looks like. Really?
I had him pegged as the main character from The Princess Bride.
Interesting. Interesting.
Just my image. Just what? Says nothing about me.
Yeah. Okay.
Yourself?
I imagined him being much squarer and having shorter, darker hair.
Gaston, I understand. Now...
No, not Gaston. More Prince Caspian. Ooh.
Good choice. So, in this scene, he plants his kiss on Poppy, and we learn an incredible detail about Poppy when this happens, is that her very first thought is, he pulls back and he goes, you're not the woman I thought you were. And Poppy thinks, it's because I'm not a very good kisser. Oh no.
Poppy is simultaneously extraordinarily confident and outrageously insecure.
She has this incredible dichotomy of being like, yes, I will risk my life, my position, and also my beliefs on how this society functions to go out and help the little people. At the same time, she is not confident enough in how she comes across, looks, speaks, it's almost like she genuinely has this kind of day to night sort of role. When she slips away, she gains the confidence, and then when just as soon as she's like back in her sort of gilded cage, she's like, nope.
Oh, you're giving this book way too much credit, Duncan, because you almost made it sound like there was some sort of like motif or theme around how like putting on the mask which she wears to go to sneak away is her way of like inhabiting a new persona, and that fills her with courage. And that is completely, you're giving it way too much credit, because the cognitive dissonance is there constantly, wherever she is. The blending of switching between immense insecurity of being like, oh, there's no way that he could ever find me interesting or appealing and I must be doing all of this wrong, and being like, I'm so clever, I'm so smart, I'm so brave, he's an idiot for disagreeing with me, all of these people, they have no idea how much they're underestimating me. It's kind of bizarre the way in which it just flips back and forth, considering how much time, even when Poppy is outwardly appearing confident, the fact that 80% of his book is in a monologue, as you said earlier, something happens, Poppy comments on it. Actually, you didn't say that earlier. You said it in a bit that's now deleted. 80% of his book is Poppy's inner monologue. Something will happen. She will think about what just happened. She will provide historical context for why something just happened. She will then respond emotionally to what just happened, think about how she ought to react and how she presents herself, and then she will reply.
Can I just say, actually, real call out to this. The way this book does exposition is, like, it's not bad. It's actually a completely valid way to deal with it, which is, you know, your first-person narrator thinks about the history and thus tells you the history. I just really noticed it in this book because some of these exposition dumps were so large and came like mid-conversations. Like someone will say something to Poppy. Poppy will think about, oh yes, this relates back to the history of the Atlanteans and the wars that were fought between here, here, and here, and here, and this person, they're related to them. And then she'll just reply, and you're like, wait, was that meant to be in, like, a second of thought? Or what? Like, there's never a conversation about the history. Well, maybe that's a bit unfair. But it's not like it's a conversation about, like, the history, and that's what's expanding around. It will always be, like, a kind of side-related conversation that has its own point, and then we just get a dump midway. And it just happened one too many times that I was kind of like, I'm noticing this, so it's probably not being paced properly.
Now, let me tell you something, Duncan, which you cannot have experienced on your first read-through of this book. Because you don't have the same context that I do, or that I read this book, and then when the second one came out, I read that one to completion. Because my impression of reading this book, with all of the bits where Poppy will take a break to explain the world to us, is I think to myself, wow, this really is lasting a long time, considering that almost all of this information is redundant, because it's not true. A big motif throughout the book is about deception. It's about lies, about being caged by lies, and the way in which living in the context of having been told lies devours agency. Everything Poppy thinks she knows about the world is wrong. Now, granted, almost all of this is explained in the last third of a book where Duncan was very sleepy. So I understand that you may not have been able to like pick up on some of this stuff. That's fair. But the entire next book is Poppy saying, that's not true, I was always taught this. And then the character of Kieran saying, ugh, God, you're annoying, here's the actual thing that happened in history. The actual history of the world is explained to Poppy, she asks subsequent questions, and then they go, ugh, why do you ask so many questions? And then you'll turn to the next page and it's just covered in blood, because that's where I tore my nails down my face about how irksome and repetitive the sequel was.
I know, I do want to say, and that's very interesting, obviously, to now know that, like, the fake, because it's all fake history. So for us, it's entertaining to read. The sort of in-universe context is not massively important. In fact, it can be quite interesting to see how certain events get kind of turned on their heads, and the sort of how has the propaganda spin been applied.
Yeah, we've just finished reading Andor,
so this is all at the head of my mind as well. You're right, and in Mistborn, it can be a very interesting subject. depending on how it's explored and how it links into our character's journey. For me, Geordie, Poppy's journey in this book, okay, I need to get some structure here to this book. We've talked about quite a few aspects. Basically, this book was, I wasn't hooked for 2/3. There were some good scenes. A big twist happened, and then things kind of went off the rails for both. Things started happening, and things started happening that I very much disliked. And I feel like I need to put a lot of time nearer that back end of the conversation. So I do want us to just hit on like some of the more, I don't know, positive aspects first in the earlier sections of this book.
Go ahead.
Okay, here I am, on the spot. What did I like? There's a bit in this book that is not explored nearly enough that I really enjoyed, and it's very early on we learn that Poppy sneaks out with her one of her bodyguards, Victor, to go and help the common folk. And the way they do this is, so the enemy in this world are called the Kraven, and they're zombie vampire hybrid-y monsters.
Yes, they're created by the Atlanteans, more in that stupid name later, who are, like, genuine, typical vampires.
So, when these people get created, they get infected, and the official process by the state is that it is public execution and dumped on the bonfire. But, Geordie, people deserve to die with dignity. And what I thought may have been opening the door on a very interesting conversation around euthanasia. Poppy goes out to kind of give the last words to a dying person who's been infected. His wife, they go to them, the wife is like, he came back, we tried to hide it, we just hoped it would go away. And they're like, we understand, we're here now, don't worry, we'll take care of this. And they go up and they have a nice conversation with him, and then they quickly, painlessly, dagger to the back of the head.
Right.
And it's lights out. And it's genuinely
we should also
like,
point out that, because we haven't actually mentioned this point, Poppy does have magical powers. Her magical powers are supposed to be that she can sense pain, both physical and emotional, but she can also, through touch, remove people's pain. She can cancel it out by thinking happy thoughts.
Which, again, is an aspect that probably isn't explored enough in terms of the importance of pain. Maybe this is a theme later on.
It's more significant in the second book, that is true.
Fair enough. So she's trying to help people, and I really like this aspect of her character, because it kind of speaks to the fact that this is why she's our hero. She has compassion for the common people. She wants to take away people's pain and suffering. I love the motif of like everyone deserves to die with dignity, which comes up several times in this book, and that she's willing to risk, you know, her life, her position, the society's order in many respects, to be compassionate and go against the state. And this is one like the second, maybe third chapter, and I'm not gonna lie, Geordie, I was rubbing my hands at this one. I went, okay, book, you got me back. We're on the right path. Yeah, this was like a small positive blip. This like never gets revisited.
It's really strange actually, because a lot of the stuff around, as you rightly said, what makes her the hero is that she's compassionate, that she's kind, and that she is revolting against the state in a small way. She hasn't fully come out to be like, I'm against the evil that I see above me, and I'm doing something about it. And it's strange that this just doesn't happen. The only other time where she's going out and doing something heroic, it doesn't relate to compassion. It's where she's on the rise, the war that surrounds the city, and she's shooting Kraven with a bow. And to be honest, like, as much as it's fun to have, like, a, you know, this badass hero character who's, you know, she's fighting people with her physical strength, you know, that's fun and all, but it's not as complex or nuanced as that earlier scene.
No, and again, it was, I feel like I feel most annoyed by it for how much it tantalised me early on. It's like, oh, Duncan, do you like that? Do you like the complexity? Do you like the idea of these kind of deep questions and the hard decisions a character has to make? You enjoy that? You enjoy that? Yeah, no, you're not getting that. It's like, how dare you?
It's
Jennifer Armentrout.
It's kind of funny. It is kind of weird that, you know, this book is about, you know, it's about female liberation. Like, that's a thing that is constantly harped on about. Harped on sounds extremely negative. It's something which the main character thinks and talks about all the time, about the power of her choice, about the significance of her choosing to have this relationship with Hawk, because her being able to make a choice is significant, is an act of rebellion in itself. That is what the book is claiming, and we can talk about the strength of that motif later. Because what Poppy lacks as a character is agency. At a certain point, Poppy has to leave the city. Up to this point, the entire book has been set in the city of Macedonia. That is what it's called. It's called Macedonia. I really can't, it's genuinely hard to get over how ridiculous and stupid and thoughtless the naming and world building in this book is. There is a city called Pompeii, spelt P-O-M-P-A-Y. There's a Nile Valley, but the word Nile is misspelt. The main city where she's going to be shipped off to is called Carcedonia. Oh, do you get it? Like carcery? Like incarcerated? Fucking hell.
Okay, I'm going to say, like, normal words, twisted, changed spelling names. It's not that alone, I don't think, is some condemnable sin beyond all forgiveness. Condemnable sin beyond all forgiveness. Unforgivable sin. It's not that that really gets me. It's the fact that, like, the cultures wrapped around it don't seem to really reflect the namesakes it's putting on. If I'm going to create a fantasy world and, you know, set it in, I'm trying to think of a fake name for, like, Rome. In Rome. We're going to Rome.
In Rome.
In Rome. X, much better pick. Yeah. If we're going to go to Rome, then you might as well just dress it up almost, and I know this is deeply intentional and the big point of the series, almost in, like, Northern Lights by Philip Pullman, his Dark Materials. It's so you're like, oh yeah, this is just Rome, but I'm in a fantasy setting, so I don't need to hold it up to historical accuracy standards, but I inherently know what to picture in my mind for architecture, culture, societal hierarchy. It's all kind of there, and that's fine. Yes. I don't mind people playing with that.
And what you're recognizing this is there's this Greek, this Hellenistic influence in the naming conventions of the world. The, like, the monstrous people who they defeated in the War of Two Kings are the Atlanteans. So in this book, Atlanteans, who come, by the way, from Atlantia, that is just so annoying. It's just so, it's like a little, it's like a little nettle thorn in my brain, Atlantia. So, Atlantis is obviously, like, a Greek, it's not even a Greek, like, myth, it's like it's a story, it's literally just a story, made up, probably by Plato, or Archimedes, or related by him, and it's supposed to be, like, a moral, you know, this is a society which strayed from the gods, they were too hubristic, and they were punished. And then, a lot of stuff in this is Greek-coded. Now, the stuff they wear doesn't, they don't use Greek names for that. Most of the characters don't have, like, Greek names. And it does really, really amusingly. Jennifer Armentrout has, by naming one of the places in it Macedonia, accidentally hurtled headfirst into the fraught topic of Balkan ethnicities. Are Macedonians Greek? Asks Jennifer Armentrout, a question which will get you beat up in a lot of different parts of Eastern Europe.
It's a sticky subject that I don't think Jennifer Armentrout was in any way intending to broach. And like you said, it's about, I don't know if it's actually, this is what you said, maybe it's what I said. It's about identity and aesthetic, and I don't feel like she's actually really engaging with these namesakes to draw upon that, at which point I'm sitting here wondering, oh, why bother?
Yeah, in the second book, to get sidetracked for a second, they go to a, like, Atlantean city, and there's a group of female warriors training who are called Amazons, and they do not do anything in the book. they meet one character from that group. I believe they probably do contribute to the final battle, but not in any interesting or exciting way. So she uses the word Amazons because she thinks Amazons are cool. She doesn't actually factor them into that story in any way that is remotely compelling, but she uses the name. And she's again is tied into like a Greek, like mythic identity. The weird thing though is that like the werewolves in this book, they're called Wolven. And so she's gone out of her way to avoid using these standard fantasy names. Vampires are called Atlanteans, but there's another different type of vampire. The Ascended are called Vampri, which I also find irritating. It's just, it's so unimaginative that it's like, why did you even bother? You just rearranged the letters a tiny bit. Why did you bother? Why did you call it Pompeii? Why did you spell it like that? And then, but Wolven, right? So there's Wolven. Meaning they are, these are the werewolves.
Makes sense. What's your problem, Geordie?
Well, so you were too shy to use the word werewolf. You didn't like that. So you went to another way of saying the same thing. But you didn't go to the obvious place, right? The most obvious place to think, where everyone else goes when they don't want to use the word werewolf, is they go to lycanthrope. And alternatively, if you want to shorten even more, you could go for lycan. You know, that's what they do in the Underworld series. And maybe you should have gone for the word lycan, because everything else in this book is supposed to be, like, really Greek-oriented. And you chose to use, like, the Germanic English version of werewolf, and not the Greek version, because lycanthrope is Greek. Lycos means wolf, so why didn't you call them lycans? Like, everything else in this book is Greek. Why is this part Greek?
To be fair, I kind of think a bit facetious there. I too was having the same kind of like lichen. I was like, wouldn't that make so much more sense at this point? Also, can I ask you, Geordie, and this is completely off topic, have you ever played the Fable video games?
You've asked me this many times and the answer is still no.
Right, you get on it when they bring out another one, maybe. In that series, they call their werewolf creatures like Balverines, and I've never bothered to Google if that has like some folklore-y origins somewhere, or if that's just like a game original.
I don't know. Maybe a Balnefshi?
I could know. I could have known at any point if I could be asked to Google. But instead, I ask you this question, take up time on our podcast. The type of guy I am.
Maybe Vereen is supposed to be like Wolverine.
Oh, yeah. You want to do one more positive point before we get right into the thick of the weeds?
I can think of something. Give me a second. Yeah, okay. So, much like, say, Fourth Wing, which has come up a surprisingly small amount in this book so far, interestingly, in something like Fourth Wing, there's an obsession with the main female character only getting to use little dainty weapons, like knives and short swords. A lot of these writers are terrified of giving their main heroine, when she fights, and Poppy does fight, and she's extremely good at fighting, like a real weapon built for war. That is somewhat true in this book, because Poppy's main weapon is a dagger. But at one point, when she's in a fight, she uses the dagger to stab someone who's using an axe, and then she picks up the axe, and she fights with that. And I went, wow, that's super unusual, actually, for the main female character to get to use like practical normal weapons, especially an axe, which is not like the typical feminine weapons which these heroes are compelled to use most of the time. So I really like that. And she, like, it's a scene where she throws the axe across the room to save someone and then has to go back to the dagger, stab someone, and then picks up their sword. Yeah!
Awesome. No, that's a really cool scene. And actually, I do like seeing that. You know, this is not a combat-focused book, but the idea of, like, taking your enemy's weapons and being very much on the fly, it's cool. And the fight scenes, although not anywhere near, like, top tier, were better than I felt like they needed to be for the overall story being put forward.
I'd agree with that. I'd say that's fair.
I think even the scene I think we alluded to earlier when she picks up the bow and is fighting the Kraven from the battlements, and I was like, damn girl, you got it, this is cool.
Yeah, yeah, that scene was okay. I mean, I when they did the like fight between Hawk and Poppy right after that, upon rereading, I liked it substantially less because it felt very very fourth wingy.
I'm not gonna lie, it mostly for me, I was like, are you, how much are you happy to kill him in this moment? Because you seem definitely like you're trying to end him. I don't think you're skilled enough.
Oh yeah, she throws a dagger full at his face.
This would be a very different book if he didn't get out of the way in that moment.
Oh god, we can dream. I think that has led us to discussing the romance now and the twist. So Duncan, a lot of this book is built around mystery and ignorance. We're provided with clues, but it's up to us as readers to try and guess where the book is going. And I really was struggling upon reading this book again to place myself back in that moment and try to figure out how much of this book did I predict, did I see coming? And I'd like to ask you that now. How obvious were the twists and turns of this book to you?
Okay, so large scale things, like that we're being lied to and it's a fake history, and the probably mm-hmm. the Atlanteans are not the ultimate bad guys, so on the nose, mm-hmm. so immediate. It's like, tell. The Ascended being creepy, basically vampires themselves. Yep, pretty straightforward. And the fact that the Maiden is like basically being prepared for sacrifice, in effect. I was that checks out. The only thing that did take me back is Hawk's identity is revealed. And while I was confident of like, this guy's probably playing for the other side, his exact identity in the Grand Tapestry, I was like, oh, didn't think we'd go there.
Yes, great. I think we're very much on the same page then. I will tell you, Duncan, I'm going to say you even had a leg up on me, because at a certain point in the book, I flipped back and forth a lot between what is Hawk's deal? It's very obvious to me from the start that he is on the side of the Dark One, which is the, like, prince of the Atlanteans. It's set up. He can control the Kraven. He's a threat to society. He's the rebel leader. And I say, okay, so he is initially seen as a bad guy by society, which means he's definitely a good guy, and they'll join his side subsequently. But as the book goes on, the Dark One and his minions are responsible for several people that Poppy loves dying. And so at that point, I think to myself, okay, so Hawk can't therefore actually be that involved. He might be a sympathizer for the Dark One, he might be against the Ascended, but there's no way he's on the same side as this guy, because that would be too much of a violation. And I especially thought this after they, one, had their second big but more sexy kiss, and two, after they slept together. To me, at that point, I was like, I have to put all of my previous suspicions out of mind. There's no way that's the case. Hawk Flynn, unfortunately, is indeed called Hawk Flynn. And whilst he's definitely on the side, he's definitely against the Ascended, he's not on the side of the Dark One.
You maybe had more credit than I did. I was at no point thinking, oh yeah, there's no coming back from that. I was like, no. The type of effectively arsehole that this love interest is going to be, he could definitely be fully on the side, and Poppy's probably still going to fall for him.
So I just cracked open my notes to read through. I had forgotten chapter 5 of this book. Just to give you a sense, Duncan, of we've said that this book is repetitious and a bit flat in places. I'm going to go further and say that it was written in a rush and it was not properly edited, because chapter 5, Armand Trout mixes up the word sadist and masochist. Those mean opposite things. She's thinking that scene, I'm not a glutton for punishment. So she says, I'm not a sadist. That's not what sadist means. It's the opposite. another thing is that Hawk, at a certain point of this book, is telling white lies to Poppy. No, sorry, throughout this book, he's telling her white lies. He's telling her stuff that is true, but she doesn't have the context to really understand. He's pulling an Aes Sedai. Except in chapter 36, where he explicitly lies to an extreme degree. He says that he says, neither the prince, meaning the Dark One, nor I wish to see you harmed.
Hmm.
Why is that a lie, Duncan?
Well, because they're one and the same.
After Poppy and Hawk sleep together, the next day, one of her other guards says, something's wrong here, we need to escape. Because at this point, she trusts Hawk so much, Poppy actually gives the game away with their escape. And is surprised when Hawk's best buddy, Kieran, suddenly turns into a wolf, chases them down, and all of the guards defending her are murdered by wolves in her presence. Well, not all of them, actually. Castile kills one of them, too.
Now, to be fair, at this point, I was genuinely thinking, is this going to be like... Now, I've not read the rest of Court of Thorns and Roses, but a lot of people say how in the latter books, the sort of love interest of the first book gets turned on his head and is actually an arsehole. I thought maybe they were going to do this angle. Like, we get set up with this one bloke, and now, instead of being like enemy to lovers, this is going to be lovers to enemies. And then maybe we'll have a new lover come in. And I was actually getting quite excited at this point of where this might be going. Didn't go there, nope. But, you know, that's my problem.
Nope.
It's on me.
Nope. So, right from the start. So, Hawk Flynn is a fake identity. He is Castiel Denier. He's the Prince of Atlantia. He is the Dark One. He is personally responsible for the deaths of numerous people that she loved. And it goes out of his way to be like, yes, my soldiers did kill your father figure, but I did not explicitly give that order.
I merely told them to attack in the general vicinity, and it's very unfortunate that, you know, casualties happen.
I don't think he even told them to attack, but he definitely riled them up. He's definitely, like, criminally responsible. He'd go to prison for conspiracy. Now, the first time I read this book, I was so... I already said that I had made the determination, basically upon them sleeping together, that, okay, he can't be the bad guy, because the book would not cross that line. But the book is all about crossing that line. We've already talked numerous times in the past about, you know, the alpha male hero, you know, the bad boy, the appeal of that, the fantasy of that. Why would you want to read about your main character, who's a woman, if you are a woman, or if you are someone of any moral character, being violated sexually? Why would you read that for titillation? But we've discussed in our Dragon Riders of Pern episode, we've talked about a little bit in the opposite, in the Fourth Wing episode, where we point out that Zayden Ryerson is this hunky bad boy, almost identical to Hawk Flynn in many ways, even down to the fact that he's keeping a major, major secret from the main love interest, which she does not know prior to them sleeping together. But we pointed out how comically committed to consent Zayden Ryerson is in that book.
Respect, brother. Like the man.
He gets to be all alpha male and tough, and then when it's time for them to have sex, he is over and over saying, are you sure you want this? Are you sure? Like, really, look at me and tell me that you're sure. It's genuinely funny. The equivalent scene of Hawk Flynn having those same discussions is, it's a good thing that we got interrupted, because if you had told me to stop, I wouldn't have. Ooh.
I understand why this is something that some people do find tantalising and do enjoy the fantasy of. I appreciate that is a market, and enjoy the fantasy literature that you enjoy. What I find quite challenging...
I just want to interrupt, because I feel like the important context we have, because if you haven't listened to those previous episodes, I think we should just quickly revisit why we've how we've discussed this before and the conclusions we've come to. So do you want to do that or shall I do that?
Go for it, Geordie.
To put it very briefly, a lot of the appeal of having the hunky alpha male who compels the main female love interest into sex is because it's it takes away the shame and the it takes away the shame of being amorous. You know, the alpha male's pursuit, the forcing, keeps your hands clean. You did not really consent to going along with the indecent act, and therefore, even though you got to have the exciting appeal of this big exciting fantasy sex, you remain in some ways chaste. You're not sullied by being easy, you know.
And again, if you enjoy this and for your own reasons, that was our personal conclusions, sort of analyzing it as sort of outsiders to the piece, no shame on that, and enjoy reading your literature that you enjoy to read. Where I feel like it kind of trips over, though, is that we're approaching this as a piece of fantasy fiction, and there's an overarching plot and narrative that we're kind of going on the ride for. And what this means is, all of a sudden, these characters that we have to sit with in other scenes for extended periods of time and root for become grossly unlikable.
Right at the start, we'd said the first chapter hits you in the head with what the book's going to be about. It's about deception. It's about people not knowing each other's identity. But I still don't think that first scene really primed me for how upsetting and violating the subsequent part would feel. So let's make something really clear. Because I was doing some research around this book and people's responses to this book, and I was actually genuinely surprised by how little this one phrase ever got brought up, especially amongst people who had a positive reaction to the book. They seemed really unwilling to even talk about it or engage with it. And that phrase is rape by deception. We're about to have a rather upsetting discussion if you find the topic of sexual violence disturbing, especially the topic of rape by deception, which is when you have sex with someone under false pretenses, where you would not otherwise have engaged in otherwise consensual sex with them because you were misled as to perhaps their purposes or their actual identity.
Safe to say, if you feel uncomfortable with those aspects and those themes, I can tell you now, this ain't the book for you. Please go and enjoy other fantasy literature.
I think there is something especially insidious about this book's depiction of this hulking alpha male hero. You know, this is not Edward Cullen, who is, yes, a bit of a stalker, but otherwise, you know, on Bella's side.
Can I say, really important, going on this journey, and this is why I love doing this podcast with you, Geordie. I've read books I never otherwise would have read, and the biggest thing that I've taken away from is how the further we go down this sort of road, the more I look back at Edward Cullen and think, gosh, people were so unkind to you.
Right, I mean, yeah, if you don't engage with, like, the actual works that surround stuff like Twilight, your first introduction to the topic of sexy vampires is Twilight, you're not going to have the context to have an actual discussion about how dark and upsetting or abusive is Edward. Like, the answer is still yes, he is those things, but he does not hold a candle to some of the other people we've come across in these books.
So, Jody, back on track.
The reason what I find it's so insidious and pervasive and genuinely unsettling is that Castile, that's his actual name, he has an advantage over her right from the start. In the opening scene, Poppy appears to have the power because her identity is protected. She gets to have that appeal we talked about before of remaining unsullied in her own way. Her identity isn't known, so she can do whatever she wants, right? But it's a lie. She got sent upstairs by an Atlantean. Castile already knows her identity. He kisses her, not thinking that she's someone else, as we've been led to believe, but knowing fully who she is. He's pushing her buttons deliberately, and I mean that in both senses of the word, pushing her buttons, in order to seduce her. He's doing this on purpose. Throughout the rest of the book, he keeps making these comments about, you're nothing like how I thought you were going to be. Because his mission was infiltrate the palace, seduce the maiden, and then kidnap her to hold her as a hostage so he can trade her for his captive brother. And as the book goes on, obviously he starts to fall in love with her, and his feelings for her become more genuine, and she's nothing like anyone else he's ever met before. And before they have sex, he tells her, I can't do this because you'll never forgive me. And this is Jennifer Armentrout laying the seeds for his redemption subsequently, because he told her, he warned her, she already had said that, you know, like, I can't do this for reasons. Now, Poppy isn't given the context. She isn't told the nature of the deception. Instead, she disrobes, and this is so overpowering that, as Castillo said before, he's unable to control himself. And then they have sex. Poppy thinks it's consensual, but it is not. It is not. It's a lie. He's deceived her, and he's violated her, and he's raped her.
And then you go quiet, so I have to step in back into the conversation.
Well, I don't...
No, I
can't... I can keep going. I've got
notes. No. It's really critical here when talking about the subject matter, because the book doesn't portray it in this light that we're talking about it. The book would kind of have you go along with the romance and this aspect and his sort of mystique and the forbidden love, and it kind of wants to sweep you away. And if you do get swept away, maybe you don't think about it. Maybe it does fly under the radar for you. But when you're sitting there and you're trying to analyse a text, and maybe... this is not me over-analysing, by the way. This is not the bar of over-analytics. You're sitting there going, oh, that was really quite intense, and like, it's... emotionally, it's really made me quite raw. I hope this book is going to give the time to the subject and address it and...
Right.
Sort of come in and speak to me about what it's just shown, and show that it's done this to start a conversation, which is a valid decision. But because it doesn't, and because it's not talked about much in the reviews and in the positive material around this book, it makes it feel highly deceptive.
In the book itself.
And in the book itself, it feels very deceptive to the reader. Almost like it's just laid this trap for someone to wander in and then have to experience this. You know, have all of this brought up. And then just go, why are you having a fuss? Stop making a fuss. This is fun. And I'm like, you cannot be like that to someone. That is not okay, book.
The book does not take this seriously enough. Yes, Poppy talks about the feeling of distrust that this invokes now after she figures it out. She feels betrayed. She feels violated. But it doesn't use the word rape. Oh no, it could never do that. I mean, that would make it too real. That would be too triggering, right? I mean, not the depiction of it on the page itself. And that's the insidious part. It's not even the fact that it's there on the page, because the book could very easily have front-loaded this and give you, the reader, the dramatic irony to know that it's coming. It could even give you an actual warning at the start. The second book in Axiom's End by Lindsay Ellis starts off the book by saying, this is a spoiler, but it's also a trigger warning. So if you want to read this book, but you're concerned about trigger warnings, you got to read this spoiler. And then you can read the spoiler, and it's going to detail the type of, not sexual violence, but this, like, feeling of violation which sits alongside it. And if you read that through, then you're going to be prepared for the book ahead. And you make the willing choice to read the spoiler to prepare yourself to know, and also know that a topic is being taken seriously. Because... and this is why I've used the word insidious. A lot of people, Duncan, don't believe in rape by deception. They don't think it's real. They don't think it's real. There are people in reality who say, oh, it's nothing really. It's like lying about your job on a first date. That's not a violation. The harmful nature of this particular type of non-con is such lower than many of the other examples we've seen of the podcast because it's pervasive and apparently permissible crime in our culture. James Bond is one of the most iconic film heroes of all time. He does it almost every movie. Almost any spy character, not only do they do it, they're lauded for it. The fact that they're able to seduce women is a marker of how cool they are. Sitcom characters do this all the time for a laugh, lying about their identity or what they do for a living in order to trick women into sleeping with them. Think, you know, like Joey Triviani. Think, Barney from How I Met Your Mother. And here's the worst part, Duncan. From The Guardian, revealed at least 25 UK spy cops had sex with deceased members of the public. At least 25 police officers who infiltrated political groups formed sexual relationships with members of the public without disclosing their identity to them, The Guardian can disclose. This is a real thing that happens, right? This was a major scandal which went on in the UK for about 10 years because the British government was sending police officers and MI5 agents to infiltrate left-wing groups within the UK. And those police officers, some of them, engaged in long-term relationships under false pretenses with women in these groups. And some of them fathered children with these women.
I feel like I need to go and sit down.
Oh, it's not even close to being done, Duncan, because in 2021, the UK government passed a Covert Human Intelligence Sources Act, which allows covert police and MI5 agents to commit crimes in order to prevent greater future crimes. This was an actual attempt by the UK government, you know, to completely fray our human rights. And I gotta be totally clear about this. It passed through the House of Commons because the Labour Party largely abstained from voting on it. Great job, Starmer. That was literally your first thing you did when you were in office. It got to the House of Lords. The House of Lords, not known for being an especially, you know, relevant or useful political entity. And at that point, in several revisions by the House of Lords, they said, hey, we're going to pass this, but maybe we shouldn't let police officers rape people. And they added that to the law, which otherwise, if they hadn't done that, would have just passed through and become law.
And just a friendly reminder to those of our international listenership, the House of Lords is the UK's unelected second assembly that some roles, in fact, most of the roles are hereditary handed down. And they somehow are our backstop on moral decency.
Oh, God, I'm right heated. So this book is outrageous and it's sickening because whilst it pays lip service to the idea of this being a betrayal and a violation, it doesn't stop a romance. They're too in love. They're too carried away with their feelings. When she escapes, she stabs him fully in the heart, runs off to the woods. Oh my God, I forgot the scene where his blood makes her horny.
That is so, it's such an incredible sort of dark point that's glossed over. And I don't want it to be like we're standing here. Obviously, we read fantasy literature. If we were reviewing spy thrillers, trust us, we would be coming equally as hard on the Bonds of the world. And that's why sometimes we do seem to go very hard when we do read parts, particularly books from quite a long time ago. And we kind of go hard on moral stance because we want to feel like we're hitting, I think, with a fair brush. And we're not just piling on modern romanticy works. Because I don't think it's fair to kick them down while letting other epic fantasies fly. Because that wouldn't be. That would be wrong of us. The thing that kind of gets here is the fact that the book has it done and is expecting us to sort of relish in it and find it enjoyable in a way that just completely blows my mind out and it stops my personal enjoyment and engagement with it.
We cannot make this explicit enough, right? The reason this is in this book is because we're expected to think this is hot. The betrayal is hot. The fact that they are so enamored and in love that even after this has happened and she runs off to the woods. After she stabbed him in the heart, he catches up to her, turns up stabbing in the heart, doesn't work. And they have sex out in the wilds in the snow because they're just too... They're just too bound together.
It's gross.
Yeah, it's gross.
Gross, it's just unpleasant. Gross. It pulled me out the latter part. Bad. It honestly made me go through the latter stage of this book. Again, it was late at night. Maybe I was flicking over pages. And I was generally at this point just going, please end for me. Please, can you just finish? So I don't have to award Geordie a destiny token in the next episode. I just need to technically have finished the book. There is a level, and I'm not gonna lie, I'll be honest with you, when it suddenly jumped to the blood making a horny scene, I almost was like, right, we're just so far off from the absurdist corner. I just need to like toss this book over my shoulder and just revel in the insanity. It was so far gone for me that I kind of found like, I was looking back on the earlier sections on the book, you know, those slow sort of, this is doing nothing for me, this isn't hooking me bits of the book, and thinking, why did you leave the mental stuff for the end? Why did you wait so late for it to go all cray-cray on me? Well,
actually, that's a really fair thing to say, because the pacing of this book is bizarre. Because let's get this right. You know, this is new adult, right?
Yeah.
You know, this is not a YA book. It's got sex, it's got swearing and all that stuff in it. But fundamentally, structure-wise, it's completely comparable to YA books. It's about a special girl who has a special power, who's repressed by society. She breaks free because she meets a hunky bad boy who then takes her away. But if you say read The Mortal Instruments, she's met the bad boy and had the truth of the world revealed to her by chapter, say, 10, not chapter 36. This is comparable to something like Malice, which stretches out the scene leading up to the hero's town being burnt down and him being setting forth as a hero. That's the whole book. This is the whole book of you've met the bad boy and you've learnt his identity and you've realised you've been lied to your whole life, which is chapter 10 of your typical YA fantasy book.
This to me, and going towards sort of a wrap up here, felt very much like a book that was written in response to recognition of an emerging trend. It was made big because that's what epic, big fantasy books look like. It included this content because that's what's going to capture this new, hot, ready-to-go audience. And it just didn't strike me as an earnest attempt to create a world and a narrative and characters that I could feel genuine sort of connection to on a human level versus just these props created to play out the, I don't know, supposedly tantalizing scenes.
I'm going to lay out a slightly simpler answer as to what I think is amiss with this book. Jennifer Armentrout has been writing since 2013. 2011, forgive me. So that's 15 years of her career. According to Wikipedia, in that time, she has written 80 novels and novellas.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Good going. That is some numbers.
It's astonishing. She says that she writes 8 hours a day, which the only other author I've ever heard of who does that is Stephen King, who's famous for putting out work at an astounding rate. If you're writing 7 books in 2012, and you're writing 7 books to get published in 2012... there's no way that you're actually going back and revising on your story in a way where you're going to get things consistent. You don't have time. You don't have time to write 400 novels that are released within 6 months of one another. That can't be done. You can't be writing in an effective... It's literally not possible. Unless, of course, you had ghostwriters under you. I'm not making an accusation, but that's... I mean, I think she just writes all these books really quickly and then she does not revise them heavily. I mean, there is just basic errors in this book. I have a question for you, Duncan. I can even pause the episode and also check this. I couldn't tell if this was a mistake in the book or a mistake by the voice actor, because I listened to the audiobook. Could you please go to chapter 9 of your book right at the end? So you can go to chapter 10 and go back like a page.
Okay, I want tech.
Once you're there, Duncan, what I'm going to want you to do is try and find the bit where the dissenter, who's like thrown something at the Duke, is dragged away by the guards. I'm going to try and find that.
From blood and ash, he yelled, even as the guard gripped the back of his head. We will rise, from blood and ash we will rise. Over and over he screamed the words, as even the guards dragged him through the crowd.
Okay, thank you, Duncan, that was helpful. So, do you notice the issue I have with this sentence?
As even the guards?
Yeah, as even the guards. As even the guards dragged him away. As even the guards dragged him away. That's wrong. That's just the wrong phrase.
It makes it sound like the incredulous bit is that the guards are the one doing the dragging away.
Exactly. It's bizarrely bad. And I had this visceral moment of recollection when I heard this. And I went, huh? Because I realized I had the exact same reaction in 2020, 6 years ago, where I went, what? That's wrong. What are you doing? It's so basically and obviously a mistake. It's wrong, and it feels bad. It feels perverse. It's so atrociously written. I'll give you another amazing... I genuinely think this is an astonishingly bad line. And not bad as in, like, you can laugh at it. It's bad in the staggering letdown. It's a wet fart. Chapter 34. This is regarding the wolven as it's attacking them. Is that what I think it is? Says one guard. A wolven? And then someone replies, unless you can think of another large wolf-like creature, then yes.
Heaven forbid it's a big wolf.
So much of that sentence is amazingly redundant. It beggars the mind. It's so absent of humour. It feels like it should be a joke.
It's meant to be that, isn't it? It's meant to be a... Well, obviously.
That is the point of it, right? But to me, it is so clumsily, boringly, and poorly phrased that it strikes me as a dearth of imagination. It feels like she couldn't think of something actually witty to say. Like, again...
It's the yen then yes for me, because it's like saying
then
is that
yes
a vamp-
is incredible.
Yeah, it's if you just said is that a vampire and they go unless you can think of another type of bloodsucker, like you don't need the then yes.
No, but even that, Duncan, is too good. Like even that is too like it's a wolven and then the next word over is wolf like. You know,
that's like saying is it a bear unless you can think of something else another type of bear like creature then yes.
I kicked myself for not saying it during the episode, so I have to say it now in the editing bay. Speaking of poor choices of language, she repeatedly does something which I have seen in so many writing classes from people who cannot write. And to me, is the number one indicator that the person who you're reading is probably like a teenager. And that is... She gets tired of using familiar, normal words and switches to using their Latin and scientific names in a non-Latin context. There's a bit where there's a scene in a crowd and she'll refer to the horses as equines because she's too afraid of using the word horse too many times in one scene. In the next book, right at the start, she uses the word ursine instead of the word bear. It's embarrassing.
I know that my emotion reaction to this is too strong, but I was very annoyed at this book by this point, and that really just set me off.
I'm going to put you out your misery, Geordie. I'm going to drag this episode to its conclusion.
I deserve to die with dignity. That you're right, Duncan.
That's right. Before you lose any, Geordie, some closing thoughts on Ash and Blood.
From Blood and Ash.
Hell.
It is an extraordinarily generic title.
This book, to me, speaks to all the points here. I personally was not hooked in on a fantasy narrative kind of ground. As we've just talked at the very end, there are some very fundamental aspects of like just questionable writing throughout, which Geordie alluded to, probably speaks to a lack of editing. There is one gross black stain against this book. I do not recommend this book to people. I will say, And I am going to throw this caveat in. I do get how there is an audience for this book, but I think even for the realms of questionable consent in romantasy works, there is just better written material out there. You owe it to yourself to read something better than this.
I mean, I agree. As my girlfriend recently told me upon refusing to finish the book Alchemized, which I had told her not to read, I want to make that clear. I asked her, "Oh, you're not reading it anymore?" And she very sorrowfully said, "No, it's not the fun kind of dubious consent." I'm going to now read all of the titles in the book series, Blood and Ash, and its sister and prequel series, Flesh and Fire. From Blood and Ash, A Kingdom of Flesh and Fire, Crown of Gilded Bones, The War of Two Queens, A Soul of Ash and Blood, The Primal of Blood and Bone, The Throne of Blood and Ash. And then the sister series was A Shadow in the Ember, A Light in the Flame, A Fire in the Flesh, Born of Blood and Ash.
We are moving on to our better works. To put a final capstone on this, if you have read this series and you felt like us, or if you've loved it, I do want to hear from people that enjoy this series. The best place to reach out is, as always,
if you loved it genuinely, congratulations on making it through to the end of this episode, because this could not have been easy. I genuinely commend you for your commitment. Well done.
Do tell us why you liked it. The best place, as always, is on our Instagram, Is This Just Fantasy Podcast, and we also have a Gmail, isthisjustfantasypodcast@gmail.com.
Duncan, I've taken this to a dark place. I genuinely was astonished by how much I hated this book. I knew I wouldn't like it, but wow, it's much worse than I remember. So are you taking us to better places? Please, please, please take us to better places.
I have some really dodgy books I also want to throw out at this point. Looking towards our 100th episode, I wanted to hit some real keynote books. And after this, I went, no, I want to give Geordie something I think he's going to enjoy. But maybe we'll still have some aspects we can kind of get our teeth into and pull it apart in areas. So I think you're going to like this one. I read this back in 2019. Really enjoyed the first book. Didn't like the sequel, but that's another story. Geordie, next time we're going to read The Lies of Locke Lamora by Scott Lynch.
We're really doing like the Reddit fantasy books now, Duncan, aren't we? We got Mistborn, Lies of Locke Lamora. Next after that, I think it'll probably be what?
Name of the Wind.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say.
I promise you, once we're past our like 100th, I'm going to dig something so ancient out the ground. You're not going to believe it. You're going to be like, Duncan, it's not that this was buried. It's because this was just outright discarded by society as a useless use of paper. Boy.
Okay, well, I'm sure this will be for the best. I genuinely, and I read this genuinely, I have no idea what this book series is about. I know that people like it and some people hate it. I don't know what it's about. Maybe thieves?
I'm going to let you discover that for yourself, Geordie.
Okay, then. I will find that out next time. I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol. Till then.
Till next time.
Bye.
So long.